Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport. Thank you for coming back to the Inside Lacrosse Podcast. I am Terry Foy, joined this time by Dartmouth head coach Sean Kerwin as we are talking about how recruiting works. This is the first of these. It's been recorded after September 1st, so very excited as contact with the class of 2027 gets underway, and this will be posting the first Monday after September 1st, so September 8th. Coach Kerwin, thank you so much for joining us. How are you doing, my man?
I'm great, Terry. Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here, excited to talk with you, and most importantly, excited to, you know, be a part of, you know, helping, you know, the listeners with this whole process, and hopefully give some clarity, at least to the best of my ability, to, you know, help guide these families in this exciting time and for future exciting times. So can't thank you enough. It's an awesome opportunity.
So we ask everybody the same first two questions because I feel like they help set the baseline. I'm candidly forgetting which order I usually go in. So I'm going to ask kind of how you regard recruiting first. How important is it to your program and do you enjoy it?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's recruiting is, you know, one of the most important things we do as college coaches. It's, you know, allows you to continue to build on the success of your program. And so it's in a lot of ways I've heard it been called the lifeblood of any program. And so, you know, we're no different. We take it incredibly seriously. We're, you know, tireless in our work ethic with the homework that we do, both with live evaluations and then, you know, the reference checks that we make. And, you know, when you ask about do we love it, you know, I always say, like, you have to in this profession, right? Because if you don't, it can really wear on you. And so I've always grown to love it. I love being on the road. I love, you know, watching the next crop of really, really talented players with this class being no different. So I've always enjoyed it from the minute that I started in college coaching. And it's part of the gig. So if you don't, you got to find ways to do it. Like I say, because it can be a grind if you don't.
How do you describe yourself as an evaluator?
I think we do a nice job. You know, I try to, you know, I think the one thing that I would pride myself on, and, you know, I ask my staff to do too, is, you know, kind of put those earmuffs and blinders on and ignore the noise and, you know, not worry about anybody else and just worry about, you know, finding the right fits for a place like Dartmouth. That's been something that's been ingrained in me since I got into this whole process, and, you know, just to, you know, find the guys that you love and really, you know, not worry at all about, you know, who else is looking at them or what the market is or anything like that. So I think we do a nice job with that, and I think we're able to find some guys that are great fits for what we're trying to build. Because of that.
That actually leads really nicely into kind of the line of questioning that I wanted to pursue with you, which is, so the volume or percentage of evaluation that occurs in the summertime and in the club and showcase ecosystem has increased dramatically every year for 20 years. But I ran into you in mid-June, call it like the second weekend of the summer, and my favorite question at the time, and it's usually my favorite question, is, you know, who's the best? Who's number one? And, you know, I wrote an article at the midpoint of the summer describing my point of view on how in the class of 27 there were four or five offensive players and three or four goalies that heading into the summer you were already aware of as being a part of that conversation. But what was remarkable about your answer was that it was somebody that fell outside of that group. And you came to that conclusion, I think, on the basis of watching him play in high school. And this was not somebody that was local to Hanover. My question for you is, how do you incorporate the scholastic games into your approach? Because these kids are playing at the same time that you're playing. It's got to be really, really taxing and really difficult.
Yeah, I think in the past it was a lot harder, but I think with the way the sport is growing and the exposure that it gets, you know, there are so many high school games that are streamed, you know, all the time. And if they're not, you know, we always use, you know, the hope is that we don't make a habit of this and that we don't have a lot of free time in May. That is certainly the goal here at Dartmouth, but right now we do. And so just, you know, utilizing that time and, you know, going back, and it doesn't matter if that's a game that happened in March or April, right? Like whether you're finding it on YouTube in a previous stream or you're reaching out to a high school coach to pick out a couple games that you know you want to, you know, fall back on. And so some of it, that comes with checking in on our, you know, our senior group that's already committed and are going to be freshmen soon, and just seeing where they're progressing. And then in turn, while you're doing that, you know, you're not just looking at them and you're saying, all right, like, who else is popping? And, you know, then, you know, as I've been doing this for a while now, it's amazing how many guys you can stumble upon by watching the guys you already have signed up. And so that was part of that process too. It's just, you know, checking in with some guys that we're really excited about being freshmen here, you know, in the coming weeks. And, you know, and so to just see, oh, well, like, who's that guy? Like, he seems pretty good. And then you find out he's a sophomore. And so you really start to that evaluation process then, just kind of by happenstance in some ways.
How do you compare evaluating a sophomore in a high school game film to then seeing him play exclusively with you know, his on-grade players a month later?
Yeah, and I think that kind of ties back to the story you were telling, right? Of, like, that was somebody that, you know, maybe was not a part of that early list. But seeing how, so, like, when you compare him with this class, like, maybe some other guys are shining a little bit more at that moment. But when you see him with, you know, competing with guys 2 years older than him, you know, and seeing the damage that he can do, I think for me, it really, you know, elevates the, you know, the marks of an evaluation, right? And you they almost count, you know, double in some ways. And so we put a lot of weight into, all right, like, who is the crew that they're going against? Just like you would in a club team, you know, if someone's producing against a stronger club team versus a weaker one, right, you put a little bit more stock into the performance they do on a bigger stage. And so high school is just, you know, an extension of that kind of mindset.
So shifting gears a little bit, one of the things that is very clear about your track record, whether it was at Brown or at UVA, is you have a tremendous knack for coaching stars, star offensive players specifically. So I'd like to just kind of trace that from the standpoint of the role that recruiting played relative to the role that development played. You know, my assumption in my memory is, you know, you kind of, I don't want to say inherited, but you know, kind of stepped into coaching some of these guys as opposed to being the one who picked them on the front end. But how do you describe what you understand of the role that Dylan Malloy's recruitment played leading up to ultimately getting the opportunity to coach him and seeing him flourish and turn into a Tewarden level player?
Yeah. It's funny you say that. I was just asked that question the other day of, like, you know, what, like, why have you had, you know, the success you've had at all the places you've been? And my answer was, you know, and I wasn't trying to, like, downplay it by any means, but it was more of, like, you know, a lot of it was right place, right time in the coaching moves that I made. And so, you know, when you think about my development, you know, and, like, what were the most important things at each stop, right? It really started with player development, because you're right, I did not recruit these guys. I, you know, these are guys that when I walked in, they were already there. And so I really, you know, early on in my career, spent a huge emphasis on, like, all right, like, how do I help the guys that we have get better? And so it's wild to think that, you know, the first time I really got to recruit, you know, coach the guys that I recruited wasn't until, you know, about midway through my Virginia career. And so that was a long time of just, like, you know, recruiting and certainly going through it and learning how to do it, but never really seeing the fruits of the labor until, like I said, until guys like Connor Schellenberger showed up, Xander Dixon. And so, you know, and that was a while. So, you know, for me, my trajectory started with, you know, a huge emphasis, and I give a ton of credit to Coach Daly and Coach Tiffany about their commitment to player development. So I learned very quickly how important that was and fell in love with that process. And then in some ways learned on the fly on how to evaluate and recruit. And so, you know, with regards to Dylan, my understanding, you know, and I know this pretty well just because, you know, we were trying to recruit Dylan the Tufts when I was there. You know, Dylan's brother was a teammate of mine. And, you know, and so Dylan was somebody that just was, you know, under the radar. Lars tells the story of, you know, finding a random grass field that he was playing on and only two other coaches were there. And sure enough, those were the three schools that were recruiting Dylan at that time at the Division I level. And so part of it was just, like, stumbling upon that diamond in the rough and, you know, looking for that type of guy that, you know, has, you know, unbelievable potential, but just looking for that opportunity. And that's something that, you know, we're trying to do here at Dartmouth as well.
You mentioned Connor Schellenberger. You know, how do you describe that story, particularly because of what you just said, which is, you know, you effectively had learned how to coach and develop before you learned how to coach and develop the guys that you recruited, which is always true, right? There is, you know, it's almost never the case that a coach learns how to coach with guys that he handpicked. But with that being said, to be able to implement those lessons kind of from like a foundational level, you know, particularly for a guy who had a really unique journey given, you know, the fact that he kind of, among other things from the standpoint of his recruitment, also chose to redshirt.
Yeah. So, you know, Connor is somebody that, you know, it's so cool, like looking back or like looking where Connor is now. And then it, like you go back and you watch his high school highlight tape. It's different than how he plays. Right. And so Connor was always somebody that we knew what we were getting on day one. You know, you're getting a very dynamic Dodger that had a, you know, an unbelievable shot both on the run and time and room, but was a little bit more in high school, a little bit more of a slasher, maybe a little bit more shoot first, but you saw the ability to process. You saw the ability to feed. And so, you know, for me, it was, you know, he had the, you know, the framework to be able to be taught like more of that true quarterback position. And so that was, you know, the plan from day one was to, you know, have him on the field and give him the keys to what we were trying to do. And so, you know, for him, it just, you know, he's such a hard worker and he's such a student of the game that, you know, he loved the idea of more, right? Learning more, taking on more, you know, and, you know, having a bigger role in everything that we're doing. And so, you know, with the intangibles that he was coming in with, while maybe he wasn't utilizing them as much in high school, they were there and they just needed to be unlocked a little bit more. And so that was a ton of fun doing that with him. And then when you think about his redshirt year, you know, I'll never forget it because, I mean, it happened to be right the COVID shutdown season. But, you know, Connor came in and wasn't playing at the level that he wanted to play in the fall. And was, you know, for me, it was pretty typical freshman growing pains. But, you know, he holds himself to such a high standard. And I think the weight of maybe some, you know, pressure that he was feeling to live up to expectations, you know, was affecting that. And so, but the minute he decided to redshirt and give himself time, it was like night and day, like literally the next practice. You saw the Connor Schellenberger that we all knew he could be, and to a point where, you know, this is like so ingrained in my mind, this, you know, of just the week of when the season got canceled. We were about to play Maryland. And we had just lost to Brown, and we were kind of in a rut. And I remember being in the office and just, you know, looking at Lars and being like, hey, is this the day that we're going to get rid of this red shirt? Because this guy could really help us right now. And sure enough, everything took care of itself. And, you know, obviously we went through the COVID shutdown and everything. And, you know, and so, but for Connor, like he really showed, you know, who he could be, at, you know, pretty much as soon as he made that decision. And so it was getting harder and harder every week to keep that redshirt tag. And so thankfully we didn't need to cross that bridge.
So I want to use that as an entry point to dive in a little bit more on the nuance of evaluating offensive players. And to the extent that this applies to, you know, other parts of the field as well, but really like, you know, triangulating processing, hands, and athleticism, because Connor obviously is a really good example of all three. Starting with hands, because I feel like it's the most difficult thing or the most esoteric thing to describe how you try to evaluate it. What, when you see it, pops?
There's a lot of things. I don't think there's like one necessarily one thing that, you know, I'd say like you gotta have this. And it can be, you know, I guess the answer I'll give you is like it can be as simple as like, you know, is he catching the ball when he shouldn't? You know? And so like obviously there's, you know, the easy part where it's like the ball's right in your stick, and you know, if you're not catching those, then that's I think a pretty obvious you know, to tell that maybe they don't have that extra level of those hands. But, you know, are you catching bad balls? Are you, you know, how are you off the deck? Like, are you able to scoop balls, you know, off the ground, you know, at an efficient rate? Because that goes into it. Like, where is your hand-eye coordination? And, you know, so for me, it's just more about, like, you know, as you keep watching, are there consistencies with the handles that somebody's making? And, you know, so that's been – there isn't, like, one specific style that we're looking for. There isn't one specific background. Like, obviously, people talk about hockey players having great hands and things like that. Like, sure, that helps. But at the end of the day, like, lacrosse is its own sport, too. And so, like, how are you doing that on the lacrosse field? And how are you doing it consistently? And that's something that can happen over time.
You kind of just answered this, but I want to be a little bit more specific, which is there any difference in the way that you would look at a Canadian versus an American lacrosse player? And specifically, just to make it easier for audiences to kind of understand, how would you describe the similarities and differences between Peyton Cormier's hands and Xander Dickson's hands?
I don't know. No one's ever asked me that. That's a really good question. You know, because obviously they're different players, and the way they move and the way they operate is different. But when it comes to their hands, there isn't that much of a difference. I think, you know, they both are able to make some, you know, really challenging plays look easy. And I think that's probably the thing that overlaps the most with the two of them. And so, again, like, I don't think there's anything, you know, too specific that we're necessarily looking for with that evaluation. Again, I think it can be kind of binary, and you know, sure, can you do it or can you not? Yeah. In a lot of ways.
All right, well then, processing, is that similar or is that less binary and there's more degrees where it's like, now we can kind of see the progress?
Yeah, so processing is an interesting one in my opinion, because you have to ignore results. Right, because like everyone can talk about a great feed that someone, you know, had that led to an assist. Like everyone remembers that, but like, are you recognizing the smart plays that don't result in successful plays? Right. So like, we have a kid that signed up to play for us that we're really excited about. That, you know, the reason that pushed me over the edge was I was at a camp watching him, and you know, the way he was processing it was so much quicker than anyone else he was working with that event. He was literally like pegging balls off kids' helmets, but they were the right read, but he was just operating at such a faster pace that the other, you know, guys couldn't keep up with. And so like, again, if you just, you know, make that binary, like he wasn't as successful at that camp, but if you strip it down and see like, hey, it really wasn't his fault and he was making all the correct decisions and seem to be anticipating things at a really, you know, high pace, it was to me, that's what really, you know, pushed me over the edge to realize this guy's got something that we want to have in our locker room.
And then I saved athleticism for last because it's very likely to be the shortest answer, but is there anything that you look for that, I mean, I guess the reason it's probably the shortest answer is because in my opinion it's the most overt, right? It's a little bit of a, you know it when you see it, but at the same time, it's one of those things that pretty much everybody can see. Is there anything unique about the way that you guys try to emphasize or delineate what is athleticism at this level relative to athleticism at this level?
No, not. I think you nailed it. It's one of those things that you got to see in person. You know, it's sometimes tape can be a little deceiving. So, you know, we try to do both with everybody that we recruit. But like when it comes to athleticism, you really feel like you got to be boots on the ground and see it in person to get a true idea of where they're at.
Shifting to a little bit of like tactical assessment, so to speak, how do you distinguish between attackmen and midfielders when it comes to making decisions on how you want to round out your roster?
You know, it's interesting. Like you know, for me, it's, you know, I'm in my office, I'm staring at my depth chart. Like, we don't have a depth chart that's, you know, split up attack or middies, it's offense. And so in a lot of ways we are, you know, we lump them all together and then just, you know, try to feel, you know, put the guys out there on attack that we feel like are going to give us the best chance to win. And then, you know, fill the rest with the midfielders. And certainly some guys, you know, can only play attack and some guys can only play midfield, but we're always looking for versatility in how we recruit. And so, you know, we've got a bunch of guys that you know, we have that, you know, may play attack for their high school, but midfield in club. And that's something that we really like, because, you know, only three attackmen, maybe four, you know, play in a game. And so, you know, you don't want to just pigeonhole yourself as far as, you know, what you can bring to the table. And so we rank it that way in our depth chart. That's how we evaluate too, is, you know, if we're going to take somebody that really can only do one of two things, you know, play midfield or play attack, like, you know, we got to make sure that those are guys that we can see a role in and really carve out a role for in that process. But, you know, we're always looking for versatility. We're always looking for guys that can bring more than one thing to the table.
So that kind of suggests that you recruit offensive players and then you recruit two-way midfielders. And I guess my question there is, does that tend to be defensive midfielders, and then if they can prove their ability to play, stay and play offense, then we'll let them do that? Or do you actually try to recruit guys who you anticipate starting their possession at the defensive end, but you project them or you can see them ending up having a, you know, Ryan Conrad or Joey Terenzi level contribution?
It's both. I think the two-way midfield position is one that's got, like, depending on what you need out of your, you know, you can have defensive-minded two-way midfielders. You can have offensive-minded two-way midfielders. You can have guys that, you know, start on the field on offense and then get back on D so you can set up your ride quicker. Or, you know, you don't have to worry about the sub-game of your opponent. And then, you know, vice versa, if you want to push tempo, if you want to trap guys in the sub game, if you want to, you know, be a better in the clear, you know, from a stick work standpoint, now you have guys that, you know, are defensive minded that go and play offense. And so we're always looking for, you know, for both in so many ways. And some of it is game dependent. You know, sometimes we're playing an opponent that we know is, you know, a half field team, and we feel like we can really take advantage in the middle of the field and transition and sub game. So those two way middies that week might have more of a D to O role versus a team that's, you know, playing at a really, you know, fast tempo and is really committed to the sub game. Now those two-way middies might have more of an O to D role that week. And so that's something that can change. We did that, you know, to use, you know, guys in the past, like Jeff Connor was the perfect example of that. Jeff's role every week changed based on our opponent and, you know, what we wanted to do to counter what their strengths were.
We're about halfway through the conversation, so I kind of want to shift from the lacrosse side of things, right, whether it's the player evaluation or the roster construction side of things, and shift into a little bit more of the relationship development. And I'm going to hit you with something that you didn't know was coming, but I also want to just inform the audience that, you know, the NCAA rules are that you're not allowed to talk about players in the class of 2026 until I don't even know how it works now, given that the NLI doesn't exist anymore, but there's some, I assume you can talk about 26s after November in some ethereal way, but then certainly aren't allowed to talk about the 27s until the same point in their senior year. So we're just going to have to speak in generalities, but I was talking to a pretty highly ranked player in the class of 27, and in August, before September 1st, his, you know, list of schools that he was interested was composed of three ACC schools and a Big East school. And then I was talking to him again this week after September 1st, and I asked whether or not there was, you know, one program that made a strong impression. And Dartmouth was the one that he said, and it was his conversation with you. So my question for you is, how do you do it? How do you try to garner the attention of players who are really highly sought after, and what's the approach? What's the conversation like?
Yeah, you know, I think that's, you know, our approach is in with this whole process is, you know, one contact point at a time, right? And just, you know, put everything you have into that first phone call. And, you know, I tell my staff all the time, like, first phone calls are there to set up a second phone call, right? And, you know, that's really what we're trying to do. And so, you know, for me, I love September 1st, not because of, you know, it's obviously exciting to start to build a class, but it's so exciting for the recruits. It's like, what a cool, tangible moment that they get of like, hey, you know, all this hard work that I poured in this sport, like they get evidence that it's paying off. And so I love the excitement that they have. You know, I try to help ease the stress, you know, because some guys can take it as a stressful time, and trying to, you know, help put in perspective is one of the first things I do, and just congratulate them and really are just incredibly grateful and thank them for carving out a, you know, a small window in their busy day to talk about Dartmouth and get to know me and this program. And so it usually starts that way. And then, you know, from there, it's, you know, my job in a lot of ways is to provide recruits information and, you know, provide recruits information about Dartmouth to help them with their process. And so, you know, that's what we try to do. We try to, you know, just, you know, we're not, you know, I don't necessarily think we're the most aggressive as far as, like, we're not racing to put timelines or anything like that on anybody. You know, we're there to try to align our timelines with the recruits that we're excited about. And so a lot of that is just continuing to, you know, tell them about, you know, what makes a place like this great, continuing to, you know, help answer the questions that they have, or more importantly, like, you know, touch on the topics that they've been thinking about that are important to them. And so, you know, by doing that, I think you have an opportunity to relate to the guys and really help them, you know, in that process without ever feeling like there's, you know, pressure or anything like that. And so I really enjoy it. I get to talk to some fantastic, fantastic young men who are just starting this process. And so I've always enjoyed it. So I think our conversations are light. They're fun. They're energetic. And, you know, again, it's a busy time. There's no doubt about it. You know, September 1st is, you know, one of the most exhausting and busy days of the year for any coach and, you know, and a lot of these recruits that are getting that attention. And so, but it's just a joy to start to build relationships with guys that you're hoping that'll, you know, be a part of your program for years to come.
What's an example of a good question that you were asked by a recruit that you were just like, oh, okay, I'm glad that you care about that. I'm glad that you it thought to ask that.
Yeah, I'm trying to think, you know, some great ones. You know, I think that the most common ones are, you know, especially for us and, you know, what's the vision of this program? I think winning is a really important thing that we, you know, the guys that we're talking to are, you know, that's, they want to go to a place where they feel like there can be success. And so, you know, I think that's been a really common, common question. You know, so for us, like if there isn't anything unique, I think a lot of these kids come in prepared and they all have the same type of question that they want to ask, you know, where we see them fit, you know, what's our style of, you know, of play? What's our culture like? You know, what are we doing now that in 2 years from now we'll be, you know, allowing this program to be set up for success when they walk in the door? So that those have been really the most common ones. So, you know, off the top of my head, there isn't anything that jumps out as far as like a unique question. I get a lot of like, why'd you go there? You know, why'd you go to Dartmouth? And which I love. That's, you know, one of my favorite questions. I've been getting it since the minute I signed the dotted line here. And so that's one.
What's the answer?
This is a place where we can win. And, you know, for me, it was, you know, to progress in my career. I was never going to leave Virginia for another assistant job. So, you know, it was at some point to become a head coach. And, you know, just like these kids, like winning is important, you know, and to be at, you know, an elite academic institution and feel like there's a path to success that's in our control is really exciting to me. And so it was I'm not concerned with any of the history of a place like Dartmouth when it comes to like the lack of consistent success. You know, obviously love the history and getting to meet these alums and what, you know, what makes this place tick. But when it comes to, you know, that mindset of like, well, this place hasn't really done it before at a consistent level, I was never concerned about that, because for me it's all about, you know, what's in store for the future. And you know, if we feel like this is a place that, you know, doesn't have anything out of our control to be successful, we're gonna, you know, this is an opportunity that excites me and has excited a lot of guys that have signed up, because they feel the same belief that we have.
So one of the things that is easy to infer is, you know, one of seven Ivy League programs and probably, you know, the most remote and rural campus. And so that element of, you know, that appeals to a lot of people, whether, you know, kind of just an outdoors type of lifestyle. Is it fair to say that that's among the most unique attributes of Dartmouth and that that informs the underpinning of the culture?
Yeah, I do. And I think, you know, there's so many things, aspects of Dartmouth that make us unique compared to our competitors. And what that does is it, you know, allows us to really sift through like, are like who truly wants to be here and like who truly wants to, you know, have the opportunity that we can provide, because we are so different, both from, you know, our location to where our academic calendar set up to the where our program is. And so like all of those things go into the factors of, and some guys choose not to, you know, pursue Dartmouth for various reasons of those three. And for us, it's like, all right, well, they're just not the fit that we were looking for in a lot of ways. And so, you know, Dartmouth can do the homework for us in some ways. So we know that if someone's going to sign up to be a part of our program, like they are the right fit. They're you know, committing for the right reasons and, you know, are committed to building something special and creating a, you know, a legacy of success that, you know, maybe hasn't been established here as often.
So one of the elements of that, and I just want to remind folks, you know, not necessarily talking in specific terms, but in your 26th class, there's a very high profile recruit who, you know, two elements of the story that I think are important or you're unique or interesting. One being, you know, really wanted an experience like Dartmouth. So how do you describe that in the context of, you know, sometimes it plays to your favor because, you know, maybe the kid that you're most interested in isn't interested in an urban environment or, you know, going farther away or whatever the case may be. How do you describe the way in which you kind of, to the point that you made about Dartmouth doing the homework for you, that can be a point of differentiation in a positive way.
Yeah, there's no question, right? And so, you know, if somebody doesn't love the hustle and bustle of a city, right? If somebody wants a smaller, you know, close-knit environment and more of a, you know, a true community, like Dartmouth, you know, because we only have, you know, Hanover in the college, it's, you know, it's a really tight-knit school community, you know, and you're, you know, our student teacher ratio is incredibly low. Like, you're going to get to know your professors, you're going to, you know, really feel like you're taught by some of the best professors in the world, and, you know, and you're not getting lost in 300 400 person lecture halls, or, you know, getting taught by TAs or anything like that. And so, you know, a lot of people are drawn to that. A lot of people love, like you said, love the outdoors, love, you know, being away from that urban environment. You know, and I think too, the way our academic calendar is set up, there really isn't majors that are off limits. So there's a lot of, you know, opportunities to study what you want to study, and, you know, potentially minor or double major in things, because you're going to have the time, you know, being on the quarter system here at Dartmouth and only taking three classes a term, gives you a lot of flexibility in what you want to study. So, you know, that's been a huge draw for guys too. If, you know, someone's interested in engineering or pre-med or, you know, things like that, like it opens the doors for those opportunities as well.
I want to come back to something about that player's journey, but first, this is a good opportunity to address two things that I think are interesting or important about the program, which is, you know, that have kind of evolved recently. So the first is the presence of an indoor facility, right?
Yeah, you're smiling. It helps. That definitely helps. You know, I think for us, like, we don't use it that often, right? I think for us, like, our weather, what's really nice is where our field is located, there really isn't a ton of wind there. So, like, you know, when you think about cold temps, like, there's one thing to look at what the temp is outside, and there's the other thing of factoring the wind chill factor, and that's not something we're too concerned with. And so, you know, it's really not as bad as you may think when it comes to that. And so, you know, and our indoor facility is a little bit short, so we can't play a game in there, and so we try to practice outside as much as we can. And so, you know, for us, it's like, you know, every now and then the extreme cold temps that, you know, New England will get in general, like, there might be some times where we go inside just to, you know, if it's more of a thinking day and, you know, we're installing things, you know, instead of having our guys, you know, shivering, it's, you know, let's get them inside where they can, you know, process and think and learn what we're trying to put in, you know. But if it's up and down and the field's cleared, like, we're getting out there, and we know that that's in turn can be a huge competitive advantage for us on game day. You know, I always say that if we could, you know, play a game in the indoor, like, that helps our opponents probably more than it helps us, you know. And so we want our opponents to be out there outside. We want them in those elements. We want them in the woods, you know, playing on Scully Fahey Field. And so our guys love it. And then, but the indoor is great for, you know, those moments where you need it. You know, if it's actively snowing, if there's thunderstorms that roll in the fall or spring. But then where it really unlocks a lot of that, you know, tying it back to player development is, you know, it's open for our guys to use. And so, you know, if they want to get shots, you know, after a day of studying at the library and it's, you know, 10:30, 11 o'clock at night, they want to go hit the wall or get some shots up to decompress, like, they can go do that in the indoor, and it's, you know, accessible to all varsity athletes as long as there's not a team practicing in there. So the accessibility of that place is tremendous too. So it's a huge resource to have. You know, we find, like, it helps our guys more so in that individual player development than anything else.
And then the other thing is something that's a little bit of a blind spot for me, so I might need your help to kind of flesh out my understanding of it. But wasn't there a time when either studying abroad was mandated during junior year, and that created a significant hamper or limitation for the program, and it's no longer kind of the same situation as it used to be?
Yeah, I mean, it's crazy to think that, you know, up until fairly recently, you know, every fall Dartmouth lacrosse would be missing its junior class. Because of something that we call sophomore summer here, where, you know, after your sophomore spring, you know, the entire class stays up and takes a summer term, a 10-week term. And, you know, because of that, you'd have to take a term off the year following your junior year. And, of course, for a spring athlete, you're never going to take winter or spring because that's when your season is. And so it always had to be in front of your season, which was a real challenge and something that I needed to learn about when I was interviewing for this job. And, you know, was very happy to know that sophomore summer for spring athletes has now become optional. So our guys don't have to do it anymore. And so, you know, a lot of our guys choose not to because they want to be on in the fall, and they want to compete in our fall scrimmages and all of that. And so it does create again, when we talked about, you know, why I took this job and talked about those things that are out of your control that would hold you back from success, that would have been one of them. And so for that to be cleared up and for us to have, you know, that, you know, not be a detriment to the program is huge. And so that was, you know, well established before I got there. So that was a pleasant change to learn about.
Doubling back on the prominent 26 commit that I referred to, another element of his story that I'm hopeful that you can speak to is the fact that he didn't play in his rising junior summer. And that's something that you're familiar with Ryan Dunkel and McCabe Millen having also experienced that. And the reason I'm particularly interested in your perspective on it is because I'm so sympathetic to the kids who got injured in their sophomore spring. And so as a result, they miss that summer. How do you, and maybe this comes back to the point that we were talking about with respect to evaluating that Scholastic video, but how do you try to keep guys that weren't on the summer circuit on your radar? And how do you incorporate your evaluation into the evaluations of the guys that did play this past summer?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. And, you know, it definitely ties back to the fact that, you know, we definitely try to do our homework from the high school standpoint. Again, having the month of May open allowed us to, you know, that year to really go back and you know, kind of comb through some high school games. And but even before that, right, like, you know, we start the evaluation of the next group, you know, come that fall. And so there were opportunities to evaluate that fall and, you know, at the IMLCA event in December, that, you know, we make sure we don't waste those evaluations either. And, you know, those are things that we'll revisit as well. And, you know, we've got a young man here that's going to be a freshman who, you know, I remember watching him in the fall when I was at Virginia, and I thought he was one of the best players on the field. And then, you know, he had a up and down and some injuries, you know, in the summer as well. And sure enough, you know, we had an opportunity to recruit him, and he's going to start here in a week to and be a part of our program. So, you know, again, just from, you know, making sure you don't waste those evaluations, you're not just going through the motions there, and, you know, and making sure you circle back on them and you don't forget that they exist, because that certainly helped as well.
That's actually a good point, right, is incorporating while differentiating the fact that, you know, there are some guys who just didn't perform as well in that pivotal rising junior summer because they were carrying an injury. They played, but they didn't play as well as they previously had. And kind of, is that a market inefficiency? Kind of both elements, right? So basically, is there a market inefficiency in overemphasizing one season relative to the prior, you know, call it sophomore spring, sophomore fall, rising sophomore summer?
Yeah, I mean, I think that you could make an argument for that for sure. You know, I think for us, we try to make sure that we don't just put all of our eggs in the summer basket, right? And I think we can't afford to in some ways here, right? We got to be creative with, you know, where we're looking, how we're evaluating, and so that's something that, you know, we're always trying to do is, you know, where can we get an edge? Where can we, you know, try to find different opportunities to evaluate these kids? And so part of that can be just like when you're watching them from a lacrosse standpoint. Another part could be, you know, watching them play another sport and seeing how they perform, you know, on the football field or, you know, on the basketball court or on the hockey, you know, in a hockey rink. And so, you know, trying to find unique ways to continue to evaluate and continue to learn about these guys, because you're making big decisions just like a kid's making a big decision, right? You know, we all want to hit on every recruit. We, you know, it's not the reality of it, but you want to try to, you know, feel great about, you know, the chance you're taking on a young man. And so, you know, part of that is the more homework you do, the more prepared you are as far as who that person is and who they are as a player can help, you know, you feel good about the, you know, taking that commitment and having them be a part of your program.
As we wind down the conversation, these have actually kind of ended in a similar spot over the course of the ones that we've recorded this year, at least. In a post-house settlement world, not a ton of impacts on the Ivy League, as you know, the league has made the decision it won't be opting in, won't be directly compensating athletes, and as a result, won't be limited to the 48-player roster cap or have to utilize the DSA tags that those that have opted in will be beholden to. Again, I always provide the caveat that is until it faces legal challenge. But with that being said, spots, admission spots, and AI, hugely important within the Ivy League. We've talked about it with other Ivy League coaches in terms of the combination of the spots that they have, as well as how that has changed over the course of their tenure. And then just a roster limit in general, right? So including, you know, prospective walk-ons that get in on their own and whether or not you can kind of find room for them in terms of the locker room. What is Dartmouth's situation?
Yeah, so we're the smallest Ivy, so I think we have a few more restrictions than maybe some other programs when it comes to, you know, our roster cap and, you know, how many guys we can fit in our locker room and things like that. But something that, you know, is growing slowly but surely, you know, because we see an opportunity to, you know, have a home for somebody that might not in some of these schools that are opting in for this. And, you know, so Dartmouth and then the rest of the Ivy League are obviously very clearly opting out of all of this. And so we feel like it's can be a huge benefit as, you know, the door might close on, you know, numbers 49 through 55 at some of these premier programs. Like, these are really good lacrosse players that, you know, I think a lot of programs would be lucky to have. And so to have the opportunity to, you know, have a home for those people is one that we don't want to miss on. So we're growing. You know, last year, my first 2 years, we've had a roster of 44, but that is slowly but surely growing.
What would be your ideal? Where is the ceiling on where, like, I don't know if I'm really getting much benefit out of going beyond that from a coaching standpoint?
To me, like, honestly, I give the NCAA some credit here. Like, I actually think they nailed it with the roster cap. I think 48 is a great number. You know, I think 48 to 50, you know, 50 gives you a little bit more breathing room as far as, you know, some of those injuries. But, you know, again, I think, you know, 44 is a great number if you're healthy. But, you know, that's the challenge that you have is that, you know, if you can't keep your roster healthy, you know, 44 can shrink to you know, 40 to 38, you know, quickly. And then now you have to, you know, change how you're practicing and things like that. So, you know, my concept and my idea has always been, you know, if you're at that 50 to 48 range, you can handle a couple injuries that, you know, unfortunately are part of the game and still land at that, like, healthy 44 number, which is great. So that in my opinion is ideal. So again, like I said, I got to give the NCAA at least some credit that they did a nice job with that.
And then from a very acutely important to the Ivy League standpoint is test optionality or the return of mandating SAT or ACT scores. So what is Dartmouth's kind of current situation on that front?
We were the first ones to bring testing back as a mandatory procedure. And very quickly after we did, a couple other schools jumped on board. And, you know, slowly but surely, the rest of the league is getting back to that. I actually think that it's a good thing. I do. I think that it allows more opportunities for somebody that may have, you know, a weaker transcript for any reasons, right? Tough school, you know, something happened, things like that. It gives another data point to admissions to get a full picture of, like, who that student athlete is. And so I actually think there's a lot of benefits to testing. And even before it was, you know, before we went back to being, you know, mandatory testing, like, we had all of our guys test anyway. And, you know, just it happened to be, like, if some guys, we didn't want to submit it, they didn't have to, but everyone tested. And because, again, if you can paint a clearer picture of who that, you know, student is in the eyes of admissions, you know, that tends to work out in our favor in a lot of ways. And so, again, I think it's a positive way more than negative. And I get it. Kids don't want to test. I understand the stresses that go with it. But, you know, it really can help open a door that might have been, you know, slightly closed otherwise.
I think that's a note to end on. Sean Kerwin, thank you so much for your time on the Inside Lacrosse Podcast. It's been great.
Yeah, thank you, Terry.
Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.